On the 150th anniversary of Juneteenth, or Emancipation Day, a day that celebrates the end of slavery in the United States, leaders, scholars, and dignitaries in the African-American community gathered at a news conference in Los Angeles for a significant announcement.
We have announced and will now move forward with bringing to light the names and information for more than 4 million individuals. That is something to be proud of.
The church-sponsored Family Search teamed up with several notable genealogical organizations and museums to release 1.5 million digitized images that contain the estimated 4 million names from the Freedmen's Bureau.
These records are especially touching because you get to get a sense of where they were at the moment when they were freed.
These are personal, sometimes difficult accounts to read from a turning point in our nation's history when our forebears were struggling with their own humanity. But what one also sees in these records is triumph and hope and resilience.
The news event not only announced an historic release of millions of Civil War era names, it was also a plea to the African American community to help bring those names online and to introduce a new website designed to aid in that goal.
We're calling this the Freedmen's Bureau Project for a reason. Although the images of the records are now available on discoverfreedmen.org, they have not been indexed, meaning the key information such as names, dates, places, have not been extracted and put in an index so that the records can be searched.
Our goal is to have all of these 1.5 million digital images indexed with that information freely available online in advance of the grand opening in 2016 of the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture.
What an exciting opportunity we have to bring one of the most important record sets to light. This will change the very fabric of genealogy for African Americans.
Maladjusted Life Podcast, James Murray here. Today, my topic is African-American genealogy, and my guest is Miss Antoinette Harrell. I was introduced to her through a Vice special. A Vice special dubbed the Slavery Detective of the South. And in this special, I'd heard things that I had heard from my family all my life, essentially. And I was like, man, I really have to talk to this lady. Here she is. Welcome to the program.
And thank you for having me on the program.
Just to start things off, can you tell people just a little bit about your background, where you're from, and the nature of your research?
Okay, I'm from Louisiana. I've been in Louisiana all my life. My root is deeply connected to Louisiana and Mississippi, South Carolina, Virginia. I started researching family history 25 years ago through my mom. My mother was the person who kept the oral history together. And I don't care how many times I call my mom in one day, she would always find a way to revisit some of our ancestors and invite them into the conversation. And at first I thought it was a little overbearing that she would do that consistently, but then it was like this light went off in my head and said, you know, she shouldn't tell you something. And I started to record what my mother told me. And I am so happy to this very day that I did that, because no one else in this very large family that I come from have ever passed the oral history down like my mother has. That was truly a gift.
Okay.
Not to say that others didn't know, but I don't think it was quite as, my mother enjoyed talking about the family history. Not to say that others didn't, but it was just profound for my mom to do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can you speak to the, the unique challenge outside of your family? Can you speak to the unique challenge of doing research when it comes to Black Americans?
As many, the first challenge that you have sometimes is just getting people in your own family to share information. Mm-hmm. I was really happy that, once again, it goes back to my mom again, that she shared that information, because there's a lot of people in the family may know, but they may not share that information. And that information oftentimes goes to the cemetery with them or to the grave with them. Mm-hmm. So that personal history that we lose when that happens. We all hear about national history, local current events, local history, but your history is very important, and we should not forget that, because it is your history that make up the local history, the national history.
Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I can definitely, personally, I can definitely vouch for that. I'm assuming it's because of the times that they lived in, but I think for a lot of Black folks, baby boomers and earlier, there are certain times that they just don't want to talk about.
Exactly. So that's a big challenge, first starting there. And then the second challenge that you may have is when you start to research your family history, moving beyond the four walls of your home and start looking into public records, you may not find records. And we're seeing it more and more. I'm seeing it more and more that local courthouses sometime may not go back past 70 years. You know, 1970 may be the records that you can find the courthouse. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, it may be in some annex or some other location. And so because the baby boomers do not pay attention, we're talking about losing very important records, land records, deeds, a connection to our family history that will tell us something about repairing ourselves. That's the first form of reparations that is important to me, is to learn about my family history. In 1863, 65, when slavery was emancipated, the first things that some men and women did, they started looking for their family. They started looking for their children. Mm-hmm. Husbands started looking for their wives, and the wives was looking for the husband. So, you know, that family is something that cannot be replaced. And we're all disconnected because we're disconnected from family, but yet connected, because once we start doing our genealogy in a very, very small area, we'll find that we're all connected one way or the other, through marriage, through family, not knowing our family history. And we often learn about family members at funerals or, you know, there was a time when a person wanted to date someone in a community, they would ask you, who's your family?
Right. Who are your people, right? I think one thing that, because I've been engaging in some family research myself, I think when I talked to you, I think I talked to you last Wednesday, I had just got my Ancestry.com results. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I looked at the ethnic makeup, the constitution of my ethnic makeup, and it was mainly, you know, as obviously West African. I'm a Black man, so it's mainly West African. But I was really shocked as to how high it was. It was about, I think it was like 92%. There was like roughly, 92% and 8% like Western European, mainly the UK, countries like Ireland. I think one thing that I've noticed, I'm kind of changing gears a little bit. One thing I've noticed is that when a lot of African Americans do this kind of do these like DNA research tests, these DNA tests, they cling so much onto the African aspect of their identity. And obviously that's a huge part of your identity. You don't want to deny that. But at the same time, I am an American. You know, my one thing I noticed that my test showed was that I am a descendant of early North Carolina and early Virginia, essentially slaves. So they were here during the colonial period. So I could, you know, be a descendant of those first few Africans who landed in Virginia. Mm-hmm. And to me, that means like I have a legacy here. Mm-hmm. I've been here a very long time. And I feel like with a lot of African Americans, they feel like they have to choose one or the other. It's like it's all it's all Africa and nothing America. It's all America and no African. It's kind of like I really want to maintain a very positive balance with the two. You know, I don't want to abandon anything because that's all a part of you. That's all a part of you.
Yeah. And I totally agree that whatever your ethnicity is, you should mm-hmm. embrace it all because it's mm-hmm. who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And to leave out one, to leave out any, is leaving out part of you. So whether that be Caucasian, Native American, Asian, whatever it is, it's your genealogy. And your genealogy is what make you the person that you are today through your DNA. So if you really wanted to give a gift to yourself, you should try to collect it all because that is knowledge of self.
Mm-hmm.
But I just know that for me, it was the African somehow that spoke very clear to me.
Mm-hmm.
But there is Caucasian lineage. There is, I have not seen any Native Americans show up anywhere, although I've heard people talk about it in the family,
mm-hmm.
but my DNA did not reveal that.
Mm-hmm.
But had it, if it did reveal that, I want to know all segments of my mm-hmm. history
mm-hmm.
as much as I can, because it is your, it's you, that's what genealogy is. It, you are trying to learn about self, you know, and that is self.
You know, speaking of the African, Native American ancestry. When it comes to the tales that many Black Americans tell themselves and tell their family members, I know that seems to be really prolific in our community. You know, the tale of the great grandmother with the high cheekbones and the long dark hair and everything like that. Why do you think that there's this, I want to call it mythology of the kind of Native American ancestor?
That's a good question because I hear that so often. Just as much as I hear, there's some European lineage, but very seldom do I hear there's the African lineage. And I guess sometimes it's passed down through the oral history.
Mm-hmm.
It's what they have been told, but it's not what they have proved, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time when you hear people say that, they are going on what was told to them.
Right.
Now, that's not to say it may not be the truth in that, but I would just say to that person, you need to do as much as you can to find out if there is any truth, or is it just a myth, or is it that someone just passing this down? And for the most part, I don't believe that people just say that. Someone had to tell them.
Right.
They had to hear it from somewhere. Mm-hmm. And I would challenge myself to find out where did that come from and why. Mm-hmm. I was just helping a friend of mine research his family history. And he have always known that there was some type of Native American. And I can see it in him.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to Ancestry and I was doing some research on his family, and I did find his family connected to the Cherokee Dall Roll in Virginia. And so when we did a little bit in-depth research to find out that it was an ethnic cleansing. Well, they would list them as mulattoes before they list them as Cherokee Indians.
Hmm.
And so down through the generations, some of the native descendants of the Cherokee Indians, they would not claim the Indian heritage because it was told to them, do not ever say that you're a Cherokee Indian. And so that conversation came up, and that was the very first time that I had heard about the paper ethnicity cleansing of the genocide through the pencil. And that was, do not claim any Cherokee Indian heritage. And so that was really new in his research, but it was also good for me too, because I learned something new. And I learned something new in genealogy every day, not only through my research, but helping other people.
Hmm. Wow. I know that there's a long history of, you know, people claiming indigenous heritage in the country, to the point where at one point people could actually buy that. You know, you could buy, you know, papers actually saying that you had a Native American ancestry. And, you know, from that you get the terms like, you know, $10 Indian, whatever. I'm not sure you'd be familiar with those phrases, but so even to this day, you know, when people, anytime any non-indigenous person says, you know, they have an indigenous background, I just kind of roll my eyes, you know, and a lot of Native American groups, they don't really associate someone's membership with their group based on blood lineage. It's not necessarily based on blood lineage. You have to have like a tribal, quote unquote, I don't like to use the word tribe, but a quote unquote tribal affiliation. It's not just based on blood lineage. But anyway, back on the topic of African Americans, like claiming Native American ancestry, I know in my lifetime, I remember my great grandmother was kind of a fairly fair skinned lady. Had a more aquiline nose, kind of a long, kind of narrow nose and bright eyes and whatever. And I know my mother and my grandmother would always say that, you know, she had a Native American background when I was a kid. And even as a kid, knowing what I knew about history, I was like, chances are that's probably a white mixture. That's probably a white mixture. It's like, I didn't see it. And they were just, they clinged on to it so much. One theory that I've heard why African Americans cling on to having the Native American ancestry in their blood is because, you know, it sounds, you can make yourself feel better if you're mixed with a group of people who are seen as free, who are seen as a free people, or who are seen as a noble people, who obviously had challenges, you know, from Europeans, but who stood their ground, as opposed to being essentially subdued by Europeans and having them in your family stock against your will. So I think, I don't know, that's kind of one theory that I often hear from people claiming why so many African Americans claim like a Native American ancestry.
Yeah. I just think that a person should, it's a great gift to give to yourself. It's just start researching, just want to know, write down some questions. That's very important. Who are my grandparents on both sides of the family? Where did they come from? You know, who is the oldest person in the family that may have knowledge that I should talk to? Those are very important questions, I would ask. So, because it's a feeling that cannot be explained other than the word great, to know who you are, to know your ancestors, to know their names, to know what they did, to know anything about them, because it's just a great feeling, when, especially if you have children, to pass that knowledge down to them. Because now technology has evolved so much since I started doing my research. There now you can take your cell phone and record oral interviews. You can take photographs. You can just do so much when interviewing that person, because a lot of times it's too late when that person passed away, and that person may be the only link to information in the family that can be helpful to you. You know, so but the younger generation, I just don't find where they're connected, where they want them. I don't know what happened. I don't know how it happened and why it happened, but it seems as though it stopped being a topic at the dining room table inside the home. Yeah. And so now that technology have evolved, a lot of young people are more connected to people who they're socializing with on the internet versus family. What was the accomplishments of my family? Genealogy is not a hobby. It is who you are. And if you ever have to open up a succession on a deceased loved one, or if you ever have to settle heir property, you'll find just how important genealogy is.
I guess you've already, sorry, go ahead.
Medical history as well. Because if there's some things, diseases in the family that can, you can learn about, that can help you to better take care of yourself, that's important as well. Very, very important.
You kind of already answered this a little bit, but I was going to ask you, and your research, and you being, I'm assuming you know like-minded people who do genealogy as well, and who research African-American history in certain areas. I was going to ask you about just like young people, their interest in connecting to the past and knowing who they are. Like I said, you answered that to some extent, but I was going to ask you, like, what else would you attribute that lack of interest to outside of just technology?
I would have to attribute that to the generation before them. Because when family members come over to the house and there's young people there, that should always be 10 to 15 minutes to talk about family business, family history, and family affairs. Asking the young people to turn off the phones, put them on vibrate, but we need to talk. And when we set the table, that is setting the table. You set the table for the conversations as the elders, as the matriarch or the patriarch of the family. It is the duty of that elder to call the family into order. And when that young person see that, they come to the table, and if that event that you're hosting is on family property, you let them know, you know, what they are a heir of. A lot of young people have no idea about anything. So I don't blame them. We can't just wait or rely upon the school, public school or private school, to teach them something that we should be teaching them at home. Let me give you for an example. Most people in rural communities, if they research their family history, they will find that somewhere somebody purchased land. Somewhere somebody purchased land. Somewhere somebody got married. Somewhere somebody could have been a midwife. Different things are different inventors in the family. Well, that child don't know that if we only focus on the Rosa Parks, Dr. King, national leadership. What about those that's in the family? I pay homage to my ancestors. There is two in particular that comes to mind. My grandfather, Jasper Harrell, and his mother, Emma. And Emma purchased 20 acres of land in 1896, which is still in the family.
Hmm.
And her father-in-law and her husband purchased 200 acres of land, although it's not in the family, but there's a lot of families that still hold on to those lessons. And I find the families who build up on knowledge of family property, family business, family unity, family support, they are stronger than those that separate, never look back, and go somewhere in another state and never look back to family again. We're stronger when we're together.
Yeah.
We are family.
Now, one thing, like the special you were in on Vice is very, very compelling and very, just very powerful, hearing some of the people tell their stories. I guess I just want to kind of hear about the reactions of people when you show them actual documents of their family members shown on a bill of sale, right? Can you explain like the reactions that you get from people that you've seen over the years, and if you can express that?
The emotions of everyone who I know, it's a very emotional moment.
Mm-hmm.
A defining moment that this is real, someone that's connected to me. You know, when the movie Roots came, the series of the Roots was first published and aired in 1977, everybody watched it with, ooh,
mm-hmm.
I can't look at this, it's too painful. But you drive it home when you search your own film. And it's a journey that you get to meet them. You're meeting your ancestors. Like they're waiting for you.
Mm-hmm.
They're waiting for you.
I think one thing that, I mean, being a Black American, I have to make this comparison. I know people get really tired of this comparison, but the comparison is always made because it's a very apt one. And I'm going to make the comparison between the way African Americans feel about their enslavement to how European Jews viewed the Holocaust, right? And so from the African American experience, I noticed that we tend to not... A lot of us, particularly young people, a lot of us tend not to want to think about that anymore. You know, it's a static thing in the past. We don't need to be thinking about it anymore. It has no effects on today. And well, we know obviously it does, but, but you know, we just don't want to think about it, right? Because it how it makes us feel. But what I found really interesting is that, you know, you have an entire group of people who tell their community to never forget, to never forget. I've never understood why so many of us don't have that mentality. I don't think to be an enslaved group of people, I don't think is necessarily anything to be ashamed of. I mean, because the phenomenal thing about that experience is that we're still here. It's amazing when I see another Black person walk down the street, I'm kind of like, wow, we're still here. That's amazing to me after all we've been through. And I think we take that for granted.
Yes.
I don't know if you want to speak to that, but
I do, because like you said, the Jewish community said, we will never forget. And it's a rite of passage for them to teach their young people mm-hmm. about the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
That rite of passage has to come in the home first, in the community,
mm-hmm.
in the community. Because history has a way of repeating itself. And when you know the history of your own family and your family's place in that society, you know when it has shown itself again. You know that slavery, you would be able to recognize slavery. You would understand police brutality. You would understand oppression and poverty and all those things that go with it. And so we some of us don't want to know. There's a Nigerian proverb to say, not to know is bad, but not to want to know is worse. And it's okay because we want to feel good. You see, we are like a feel good people. I want to be happy all the time. That's not the way life is. If we can't talk about our own history, and if we cannot pay homage to our own family members who went through that, they're the ones who survived the worst atrocities in the history of America and other countries that. And if we feel like it's not an embarrassment, for me, it was an embarrassment that my ancestors was held as slaves. It showed the strength of my family in order for me to be where I am today. Somebody was strong enough because they could have jumped overboard the slave ship when they got an opportunity to do it. They could have done that. They could have hung themselves. They could have killed themselves. They could have killed their children, but they didn't. There was some hope somewhere, some strength somewhere that said there'd be a better day. But we don't want to associate ourselves with pain, no kind of way. But when we look at the prison industrial complex, when we turn on the internet or the news and we see another young black man killed by police, you know, but if we did the research and find, and we don't have to because it's really being revealed that a lot of the police are part of the KKK, you know, so it never, so we would be able to recognize things and it would not be such a surprise because we would know that the lynchings took place. We would know how much money they made off the cotton. We would be able to recognize the commissary stores in the prison. It would be so many things that we would learn about, and we would be cautious where we spend our money at. We would be cautious about the things that we do because we don't know. We don't. And so to not talk about your family history, you're doing yourself a big injustice here. What a shame. Because, you know, it's a dishonor when people, when you think about your ancestors who was robbed of the opportunity to go to school or to be able to read and write. And here we can read and write. We can do all those things. We are very brilliant people. We can make our own documentaries. We can tell our own stories, but we choose not to do that. And it is a this is why we are in some of the state of conditions we are in today as well, because we choose not to know.
Kind of going into, you just mentioned this a little bit about reparations. And I think when people bring up reparations, they bifurcate reparations into two categories. So there's the, obviously the economic aspect of reparations, right? And then I think there's a kind of mental psychological aspect to it too. Because the point of reparations is to make a group or to make a person whole, right? You're trying to make them whole. You're trying to repair what was broken, right? And I remember when I was on the phone with you last week, you talked a little bit about kind of like the psychological mental aspect of reparations, like people needing to be made whole psychologically, and what slavery did to them, and how we're still suffering mentally from the years of Jim Crow slavery, just general white supremacy. And I guess I kind of want you to, if you could speak to it, can you speak to what exactly do you think is broken and Black Americans do to slavery?
One, the most important thing, family.
Family.
Mm-hmm. Family. Mm-hmm. When, whether the wooden inch is a true letter or a letter that some people don't believe, but I believe the formula is real.
Mm-hmm.
It said divide by any means necessary. Teach them to hate themselves and to trust only me. No respect, teach them not to have respect for each other. He broke the family down. He broke the family structure down.
Mm-hmm.
He taught us to be numb. That was the one thing that slavery did for me. I want to be home again. I want my family. There's nothing more important. There's the money, if there's ever any money from reparation, can help to give some relief in areas such as maybe home ownership, business startup funding, building. But can you repair that person as a whole? That fatherless child that grew up without a father in the home. Or that mother who sit up at night thinking that when her son is out, is he going to come back alive? Because the same things that mothers was concerned with in the 1900s is the same things that mothers and fathers are concerned with, right? In the Black male.
Mm.
It's the same concern, you know. And so no amount of money can bring back Emmett Till. No amount of money can fill the void in that mother's and that father's heart. And I want to say father because in that mother's heart. But when you look at on the other side of other ethnic groups, they see the two-parent household. No family has been broken up like the Black family of the mother and the father household. When we was first listed in the United States Federal Census started in 1870. And if you study that census from 1870 to 1940, you will see that Black men was at the head of the household. And that's how much Black families believed in the institute of family. When we fix the family in the community, we can fix the community. We can go back to repairing the community, the first family structure.
Mm-hmm.
And family structure wasn't broke down. It's just broken to be broken. There was a plan to break the family, the Black family, because the father was in the household. The mother and the father worked together to raise their children, to teach them, to guide them. And some of those families became, those fathers and mothers became the surrogate father and mother, parents to other children who came out of a different type of household.
Mm-hmm.
And so I came from the village, and I'm proud to say it took a village to raise a child.
Mm-hmm.
A village to raise a child now. It's not an island unto themselves. It was the grandmother, the aunt, the uncle, the lady next door, the man down the street. And when we stopped seeing those type of community families, because of the extended family structure, which is important. When my neighbor spoke when I was coming up, that was like somebody in my household speaking. We were strong family. Mm-hmm. Strong communities. One man, when he was building his house, he would build his house and other men in the community would help. And when they finished, they would go and help build somebody else's house. The women would can and the women would make quilts and they would come together to make those quilts. And whenever there was a need, the quilts was already made. No such thing as a hungry day, because all the farmers would share. Those that was raising livestock would share, you know, so we were strong together. And there was a time in the Black community, not just in Rosewood or Tulsa, Oklahoma, the dollar didn't leave out the Black community. It stayed circulating 9 times in that community.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other side of the track, they was hurting because they wasn't seeing our money. Like today, I was reading last night that we've had is a $9 billion industry. But we take the money over there, but they put nothing back in our community at one time. But see, the family names, whatever that family name, you was recognized by that family name. Who was that? That's Andrew's son. Because of that, you was taken care of and the community looked out for you. Opportunities was given to you because your father's name. And your father was an upholding man in the community.
I was going to say, you were talking about the just a black family in general. I was thinking about black fathers, black men in general. You know, after the Civil War, after Reconstruction, you start having, you know, the convict lease system. You know, and, you know, black men are just, I mean, black people in general, but largely black men are just nabbed up for crimes like vagrancy, not having a job, whatever. So that they basically make large aspects of black life illegal to get, you know, to extract free labor from them. And then I'm thinking of that. I'm relating that to today, where you have an overwhelming number of black men in state and federal prisons, and black men being killed by the state apparatus for ridiculous things that, you know, their white counterparts would never be killed or jailed for. I could be wrong about this stat, but I heard that there are more, and you should look this up, because this is interesting if it's true, that there are more black men in prison than there are women in prison in the entire world.
I'm not surprised.
I'm not surprised either, but like, wow. Wow. Looking at black American life, and particularly black men, it's like there's these cycles that just keep happening. Like you like history repeating itself. So I don't really see the convict lease system too much different to what's happening to us now. I think the only difference now is I feel like black men are a surplus population. You know, it's like when they can't figure out a need for you, they found a way to warehouse you.
There is a need for you.
Mm-hmm.
Now let me go back.
Okay.
Say it yourself, the 13th Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
If a man or woman goes to prison, you become involuntary servitude.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically slavery.
Right.
So the slave labor that comes out of the prison, will work so much more
inside than out.
Now, if they spend $4,000 a year per child to educate that child, but they spend $35,000 a year to incarcerate that person. Because we'll be surprised we wouldn't be surprised, but though some will be, of the type of production, mass production of produce, other type tangible goods that comes out of the prison complex. So not just the prison itself, but let's look at the phone companies. How much money do they make off a phone call? And then you can only buy goods at the commissary store.
Right.
And when you think about the commissary store, it goes back to the plantation again. It goes back to sharecropping again. You only buy from the commissary store. But very little is talked about when we don't talk about even on the plantations at the commissary store. There wasn't the people who was working on each plantation was not making U.S. mint and coins. The plantations was making their own tokens.
Huh.
Wooden tokens, metal tokens. You're working 40 hours a week for some tokens that you can only spend at this particular store, and you're paying three times as much for that item at the commissary store. Now you look at the prison. One candy bar may cost $4 that you can get at the average store for 99 cents. So when we look at the prison, and I don't think we're doing enough, we're not educating the young men in our families. And once again now, when we come together, whether that's at Big Mama's dinner or some type of event, because we love to come together over food and music, but there's a time that the music needs to be cut off for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
So that we can have some oral family discussions with our young people, so we can break down what that 13th Amendment means. We can break down some things and have some discussions and educate them about what it is that they're facing, what it is that they're dealing with. What does this mean if you become incarcerated? What does this mean? What should you be looking out for? And when we do that, we're arming ourselves with knowledge and passing this down to our children. And believe me, when they have that knowledge, some of them will make better decisions because you have talked to them. I watch many family gatherings. I don't like to attend many family gatherings. I don't like talking over music. I cannot understand. I love music like anybody else, but I cannot understand why I can't talk to the person who's sitting right next to me over the loud music.
Hmm.
And I did this as a social experiment. Now let me see what are we gonna talk about today that can help make us stronger as a family at these gatherings. The football game is on, the basketball game is on. We talk about football for about an hour.
Yeah.
All the plays and called it. And then the music world, who this one is married to, what the baby's name, all those things. But we're not talking about family business that's important to talk about in the family. Now, what does the word royalty family mean? We got to go back to that. And we got to start laying down a strong foundation. I have three grandsons, and every chance I get, I'm talking to my grandsons. I'm talking to them, and it's like they're getting ready to become teenagers. So we're having this conversation about what it is that you are faced in this world in America as a black man with racism. You know, we're having to talk about girls. We're having to talk about watching where you spend your money at. You know. So there's no conversation that I cannot hold with them from A to Z. And when I hear them come home and talk to me right now about things that happen in school, I'm saying to myself, you planted that seed. Listen to that. It's music to my ears. And it makes me want to cry inside, because I know that even when I'm not, and I tell them all the time, I'm not going to be with you always, but the lessons that I give to you will be with you long when I'm no longer here, and you will pass it down to your sons and your daughters. You need to be mindful where you spend your money, because why should you be mindful? And I give them an example. Christmas morning, I don't celebrate holidays. The next day is a celebration at breakfast club, because we didn't send somebody else on a vacation, or we didn't put somebody else's daughter or children through college or help them build their business because we let somebody tell us when it's time to give somebody a present. If I want to give you a present, I don't need anybody to tell me when to give it to you. And I don't have to celebrate your day.
Mm-hmm.
If it's his time, if he want to celebrate those days and buy things to give, that's, I don't have to partake in. So we got to start having some real conversations in our homes with our children.
Man.
And that's what everybody else do.
For sure, for sure. Man, that was pretty heavy. I guess I want to kind of get into talk a little bit more about genealogy a little bit. What do you actually think of the DNA test, being a person who's, I guess, for so long has done it, who's kind of looked at the, you know, the court records and the census data and all that? What do you think of the DNA aspect of family history?
DNA was very helpful to me.
Mm-hmm.
Because at some time or another, we're going to hit a brick wall.
Mm-hmm.
Because records may not, families may not know. We may hear that there are two different sets of Harrells, but nobody knows. Oh, that's that other set. Or the Browns, oh, that's that other set. But how do you know that's that other set when families had large numbers of children?
Mm-hmm.
And because slavery, a man could have five families, five different sets of children.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know if that person was a stud off a stud plantation, a breeding plantation.
Mm-hmm.
And so the DNA helped me to connect to family members who I couldn't find in paper. I knew that people that was other sisters and brothers that my great-grandfather had.
Mm-hmm.
But because my grandfather died when his father, my grandfather was 2 years old when his dad died, he couldn't give us much more information about his aunts and his uncle who was left in a certain area.
Mm-hmm.
But the DNA would say or connect, possibly saying, you are possibly first or second cousin to this person. And so we start to share our family tree and make that connection, because I've made a lot of connections through family that I had no idea of. And then there were some families who I knew I was first cousins with or second cousin with, and they would show up on my tree. So I said, okay, well, I'm in the right direction. And so it was very helpful to me.
Mm-hmm.
It pointed out some of the demographic areas for me. And I met some new family members, and it placed my family in different trees. But when I started to look at those trees and see those surnames, I was very, very much familiar with those surnames.
Okay.
And so I met a new family members. And so I'm grateful for that.
Mm-hmm.
My great-grandfather, my maternal great-grandfather, he had a whole another family. No one knew about it, heard about it, but the DNA connect me and this beautiful sister, cousin of mine, together, because I found his records on their family tree. And I was inquisitive to know. I wanted to know, how do we connect? And I said, okay, it all makes sense, because it goes back to my mother again. This was the oral history that was said to us. So I believe in embracing family, because family is the most valuable resource on this earth if we just realize it. If we look at the animals, how collectively some of them work together, given the elephants, for example,
mm-hmm.
the aunts, the grandmothers, the cousins take care of the baby.
Hmm.
Take that. You look at the ant, they all work together. Colonies, they all work together. We can learn that we are stronger together as a family. So I believe in DNA.
Okay. My last question, for any person, young, adult, for any person wanting to learn about their family history, outside the DNA approach, right? Because that's really easy. You just You know, you just,
that's just one part of it.
Right, you just spin the tube, whatever, and send it off. But for young people, for any group of people wanting to learn more about their family history, you know, and do the legwork, can you give them some advice about doing that?
Yes, the first thing I would say to anyone that want to get started is start with yourself. Write down as much as you know. There's a lot of free family trees, like a family sheet, a chart that you can go online and print that out and fill in what you know about your father and your mother's side.
Mm-hmm.
And if your parents is living, try to get with them as soon as possible. Call them and start asking them some questions. But write the questions down. For instance, what is your parents' name? Where did you all live? Did they have brothers and sisters? Was they religious? What church did they go to? What cemeteries did they go to? What school? Did they go to school? Was they sharecroppers? Did they ever talk about slavery? Those are some of the questions that you should write down and allow them to answer. And because there's so much, I would record it. I would use that opportunity to record that conversation. And then when you finish that conversation, you can always have it transcribed too. And ask them if there's anybody else in the family that I can talk to. And most important, ask this question. Are there anyone in the family that you know that have photographs or other documents that can be very helpful to me in this research? Where should I start looking at? And once you identify the location, you want to go out to the courthouse. And you want to start looking for marriage license. And you want to start looking at land records. And go to the genealogy library. Now, for most people that's African descent or Native American descent, Asian descent, whatever it is, you're going to find so little on your family. And that was something that inspired me to document my family history and make sure that I put that book, my family book, on the shelf in the library. So I won't feel, I don't want anybody to feel what I felt that particular day when I was searching for my family who I knew had been in this region since the forming of this parish. But there was nothing in the library on. And nobody's going to record your family history but you.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's your journey.
It is. Wow. I definitely appreciate that advice. I plan on embarking on a journey to discover my family. The DNA results are just the beginning. Like I said, that's the easy part, right? I definitely want to put in the time to do the legwork. So,
I want to say something closing out, and I have to say this because I don't want to leave this out. When you are called to look for your ancestors, there's going to be a spiritual blueprint that's going to be given to you when you start to search. Because our ancestors left footprints. You are here. You are part of that footprint. They're waiting for you to come and find out what happened to them and learn about them. And my strongest advice that I can give you is to be open. Don't think that you're crazy because you're waking up 2:00 in the morning and something just said to you, turn on a computer and go here. Do it.
Mm-hmm.
Do it. Follow the blueprint, and it's going to take you some beautiful places and some places that you could not even imagine. My journey has been a beautiful journey. It has been one that has been challenging, one that's been painful, but one that's been very joyful. Because out of that, I made sure that I wrote my family.
Mm-hmm.
I made sure that the university know their names now. Like they said, with Sandra Blaine, just call them. Say her name. Say your grandfather's name. Because we're all, see, with DNA, you're one.
Mm-hmm.
It's the past that shapes the present, and the present that shapes the future. So I don't know if you have children or maybe one day have grandkids.
Mm-hmm.
But you want to leave something for them. That money. You buy.
Definitely. Definitely. Again, Antoinette Horrell, people. I definitely enjoyed this conversation. Thank you for taking time out of your Sunday afternoon to talk to me after several months of things not going well. It finally panned out, and I'm happy about that.
Thank you for having me and being patient, because I know we had been planning it, but we could have our time set, but this was the right time, right here.
All right.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Thank you.